Obama administration actually arguing against the rights of individuals who are affected by this, providers and patients, to challenge that determination through lawsuits. It seems like that there's a significant human rights overlay to that discussion, and I just was kind of wondering your thoughts on that, or am I completely off base? Or?
No, I think you're right on. I mean, I think that, you know, we've just never looked at these cases from a human rights perspective or from a focused human rights perspective like the UN contemplates in its human rights approach. And they come up wanting, but we see the efforts over and over again by state governments with respect to Medicaid and in the interest of reducing funds, curtailing access to the services. So I think that's an excellent observation. You know, I was going to make an observation about yours, Ben. Your talk, well, why don't you guys finish commenting?
Okay.
Have you looked at health systems agencies of the National Health Planning and Resource Development Act of 1974? Because the United States went through this with these health system agencies that were on the district level. They were supposed to be health planning for the agent areas, but it might have some real interesting contributions to consider in your work.
So I think there are a number of models that are being pursued, and this was actually, the U.S. model was actually the inspiration, if not the actual legislative language, of what becomes the district health system in South Africa. And so the idea is to bring, so the idea is to bring government and the policies that affect people's health as close to the people as possible. So in an ideal world, you'd have people make health policy for themselves. In a less ideal world, you'd have families. And then you move outward and you get to the community, or the district level was considered to be the most feasible level within South Africa, which is smaller than the provincial level, which is smaller than the national level, with the idea that if most of the health policy that's affecting people's health is at the smallest level of governance possible, that it will be most responsive to the needs of the local community. In the United States, it was sort of a mixed bag, as I understand it. Some people, that rather than increasing equality, rather than decreasing inequality, it actually increased inequality across the United States, with some districts better able to deal with health problems than others. South Africa is working under this system that it's no longer even trying to achieve national level equality, but if it can at least get equality at the district level, then that's a step in the right direction.
Judicial review and a human rights approach to health. So I've always wondered if the fact that the United States has chosen been behind in a human rights perspective, in a recognition of a approach to health, is not in fact at least partially attributable to our very strong tradition of judicial review. Right, so that there are many countries in the world in which judicial review is not as well entrenched as it is in the U.S., and yet there's a greater, perhaps, recognition, or at least signing on to many of the United Nations human rights documents. Ross's question about the private right of action case, I guess, raises that question for me. Can we build in a human rights approach to health in the United States without judicial review? I mean, what's the relationship between the two?
Actually, that I think is a really intriguing question. I think because of the civil rights movement in the United States, which was generally seen as possible, the many of the early achievements in that movement were due to the careful planning of Thurgood Marshall and the NAACP, where they first went after education, first at the graduate level, then at the law school, then the university, and then got down to Brown versus Board of Education, which was the case that turned it over. We tend to think of enforcing human rights through judicial review because that was such a success story. And what I'm intrigued but judicial review has its problems. I mean, a private right of action in the Medicaid program, somebody says, well, you shouldn't do these cuts. You should, provide these services. A judge really isn't in a position to make that decision. And I don't even think that would just be a conservative perspective. I think we're all uncomfortable with judges making what are essentially political decisions. On the other hand, if we hadn't gotten judges making essentially political decisions in the civil rights movement, we didn't see any legislative progress until the mid-1960s. So I think that is a really tough issue. I'm kind of encouraged by some of these other efforts with governance and then these community councils where you kind of think of human rights as something being implemented from the ground up.
Yeah, well, and I guess I would add that I think that, I agree that it's a really intriguing question. I don't know if the United States had been more willing to, or traditionally been more willing to ratify some of these human rights treaties and explicitly recognize that these were binding provisions in U.S. law. It's possible that the judicial review, I mean, the judges would take those provisions into account and would tailor their review of the law accordingly. And so the fact that the United States hasn't done that, the judges are not necessarily and very rarely would cite to these external provisions as the basis for reviewing a decision. I think that the idea, the case, and I'm not familiar with all the details of the case, but I'm familiar with it in a very general sense. I think if the idea is that the government is going to prohibit people from challenging decisions that take away access to health services, and they are political decisions, but it seems to me that having the possibility of judicial review is a key foundational thing from a human rights perspective as well as from a constitutional rights perspective. So I don't have a good answer to the question, I don't think, but I do think to the extent that there is tension between judicial review and the achievement of human rights, one way to resolve that tension is to push for more recognition of those rights within our legal system. Now, that might be an unrealistic thing to hope for, but that would be one way, I think, that would at least bring the two less in tension.
At an international level, I think that very few countries have direct causes of action based on international law. And so to the extent that human rights are litigated in any way, they're litigated based on national law. And those national laws derive from international law, sometimes very directly, where the exact same language is taken. And sometimes it happens in a more circuitous route, where there's national implementation of what becomes a national right that in some way has some correspondence with the international right, but it's distinct in a variety of different ways. And so I think of human rights not as grounds for legal action. I say this as someone who's working on a giant human rights litigation project. But human rights is a means of normative change. And so as norms change, we memorialize them in human rights treaties. And then those human rights treaties cascade out throughout the world and change norms where they remain to be changed. And so through this, we see this most seminally in slavery, where through a series of international legal prescriptions, what was once common economic practice is swept from the globe. We see this in the end of apartheid in South Africa. And we're starting to see this under a human right to health, where it's not so much that people are looking to the international treaties to bring court cases, but that the idea that governments have certain obligations toward their own citizens has taken on a taken-for-granted quality that we would say is normative change.
Gary's having some papers in Tokyo. Thank you very much for the presentation. My two questions goes to Dr. Maya. Thank you very much for sharing your inspiring study which in which the United Nations require a number of countries to come up with a first report by 2013. And we found repeatedly a problem finding or defining community in African districts and countries with continuous wars, conflicts, high mobility. And we had a hard time how to include those people who do not belong to community, for instance, homeless people, seasonal workers. Do you find a way to include those people in the rights-based approach? That's my first question. Second question is, meeting with the health minister of Ethiopia, who found very strong leadership, he would call medical students to their cell phone to share his view of health reform and to prevent those medical students going out of the country. So we saw the highest person sharing his vision to the people in the country, plus the bottom-up community participation approach meeting and synergizing to enhance the health reform in Ethiopia. Do you find that kind of synergy in your case?
I think your first question is a particularly interesting and problematic one. So thank Ari for that. When we think about how to define community, and this goes to one of our crucial questions, is how do we decide that representatives truly represent the communities that they claim to represent? This is something that we experience in this country at a basic level of democracy. How do we protect the most vulnerable and marginalized when the most vulnerable and marginalized will clearly not be representative or represented by their elected leaders? And so in these cases, it was found, particularly in the Western Cape, that what happened with these community health committees was that there would be both elected representatives, but also if there were marginalized communities that stepped forward and said, we don't believe that we are represented, that they would simply enlarge the table. And so with community health committees, because they aren't structured under law right now, there's a lot more fluidity in how they're structured and how they run. And so sometimes they operated by majority vote, and sometimes they operated by consensus, recognizing that a majority vote would exclude marginalized communities. In fact, the most marginalized communities that they're hoping to bring into these committees. And so I think there are a variety of different ways to define community, but I think the way, and I don't want to express an opinion on it because I don't claim to know which is best, but I think the way it's been dealt with in the Western Cape is to have more fluid structures that are able to expand as the different interests in the community are identified. The other question is how you develop synergy between the community and the government. And that's really the key here, is how to develop lines of authority that are structured under law. Because currently, the Cape Metro, so things go from the Community Health Committee up to the Cape Metro Health Forum. But the Cape Metro Health Forum wants to influence provincial legislation, but they have no legislative authorization. And so without legislative authorization, the Ministry of Health knows who they are. But if they want to sit down at the budget negotiation table, the Ministry of Finance says, who are you? What is your mandate? They speak of mandates quite a bit. In Cape Town. So what is your mandate? You know, if you don't have a mandate under law, then you have no place at the table. And so synergy only exists to the extent that the lines of authority can be documented.
Yeah, and let me add to that that I think your whole case study looking at the Western Cape is it kind of straddles two of the categories that I was talking about. Without that legislative authorization, without that formal recognition, essentially, this organization is operating under that heading of devolved governance. It's not a government. It's not a formal government structure. It's a community organization. It has bottom up broad participation, and it actually has quite a lot of influence on decisions that are going on in the community. But doesn't have that formal relationship with the government unless the government decides to recognize it. It decides it wants to adopt it, its points of view. If the legislation were put into place that actually formalized that relationship, then it would be more in that second category of new governance, where you have the external and internal groups working together. And so I think that's a good illustration of what I was trying to get at too. I think that it also points out some of the problems with these approaches, especially the devolved approach, which is that it still leaves a lot of room for the formal structures, the government officials, to just disregard the work of those outside actors.
Thank you very much. I want to take this opportunity to thank our speakers again today, and thank you very much. Also to invite all of you, we have several more sessions today. We're getting ready to do a poster session at the Convention Center in the Expo Hall. If you want to join us for that on the Affordable Care Act, topics in health reform and the law. And we have two more sessions this afternoon, one on public health law evaluation and one on legal issues, public health, and the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Both of those are here in this hall. And our business meeting is tonight at 6:30, so we hope you'll join us. Thank you very much.
Where's the business meeting?
Oh, the business meeting is in, yes, it's across the hall in the Washington Boardroom here in this building. So thank you very much, and thanks again to our speakers.